Welcome to the Sunday Times Politics Weekly, where we unpack the big political stories of the week. My name is Mike Siluma. The top stories this week that we're looking at are the political meaning of Jacob Zuma's imprisonment following his surrender or his arrest by the law enforcement agencies. That will be followed by a focus on the state of play within the ANC itself, especially in the light of what has happened with the former president Jacob Zuma, as well as the suspension of Carl Niehaus, who's the spokesperson for the MKMVA. Let's welcome my guest for this week's conversation, William Gumede, who's associate professor in the School of Governance at WITS University, Thabo Mokgoni, who's our parliamentary correspondent, as well as Mawanda Mashabalala, who's been on the show before, political correspondent. He spent some time in Uganda in the last couple of days, and he'll tell us more about what he saw and heard while he was down there. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
This econ is racist.
I've never, ever been a spy.
Can the VBS bank loot us?
The problem is that pinky.
I'll never subject myself to whiteness.
Order!
I'm listening.
Can you have consistency, Honorable Chair?
Corruption was an Olympic sport. They will always win gold.
This is not a ship.
Sergeant at arms, can you please come in?
Point of order.
I want to start with you, William. When you look at the way things have panned out for the former president, what strikes you as the most important implication?
I think for me, the most important implication really is the fact that, you know, the Constitutional Court issued a judgment of contempt of court against the former president. And at the end of the day, although with a, you know, whole lot of delays that, you know, former president Jacob Zuma actually accepted the verdict and handed himself over to the prison authorities. Now, for me, the most important thing there in that story is that finally, I think, we've got equality before the law. You know, we've been struggling since 1994 to treat every citizen the same before the law. And also typically in African liberation movements since the Second World War, normally things go wrong when you have two sets of laws. You have your normal constitution, democratic institutions, and so on, but they're only applicable to ordinary citizens. And the leaders of the governing parties of the liberation movements, they normally above constitutions and above the judiciary and so on. And now there's big implications for that sort of thing, because then what happens is when you don't have the rule of law, I mean, it's very difficult, of course, then, you know, to foster peace, so societal peace in the country, very difficult to build an economy, and it's very difficult to build democracy. And often, unless countries reverses this inequality between leaders and citizens when it comes to the law, that is where we see the failed states and in Africa. And for me, that issue actually is the biggest reason for failed states, and also the biggest reason why many African countries haven't developed since the end of the Second World War.
William says that we've battled to establish that rule of law where everybody's equal, you know, before the law, you know, and the constitution. But how did this happen? How could this have happened? You know, the constitution is written there. It's clear. I think one can say that there's total agreement about, you know, the fact that we are a constitutional state and we are all subject to the constitution, etc. Nearly a quarter of a century later, we seem to be battling to assert that plain and obvious truth. How did Jacob Zuma get to the point where he got to believe that he might be above the constitution or above the law?
Sure, Pamet. I mean, Jacob Zuma really pushed the boundaries. I mean, he really tested the constitution of South Africa. From as soon as he was elected, I mean, he got emboldened as soon as he was elected in Polokwane. That's when his Stalingrad legal strategy really gained traction, challenging the decisions of the High Court, decisions of the Constitutional Court every step of the way. He's the one guy who really tested the strength of the Constitution of South Africa. It's really Jacob Zuma who put constitutional democracy of South Africa through the test. And what we saw last night was just the culmination of what he has been doing for decades, you know. And really what happened last night has affirmed that South Africa is indeed a constitutional democracy where everybody can now see that there is true meaning to what we call the legal principle of the rule of law. I think it has now been affirmed and entrenched, and everybody who, you know, has been doubting whether we would be where we are today with Jacob Zuma behind bars can now rest assured that South Africa is indeed a constitutional democracy that is working. And as Prof says, countries on the continent, I think, will take a lesson out of this.
Hey, Mawande, please come in here. You know, and I'm sitting here trying to get into the mind of former President Jacob Zuma. We've just been talking about equality before the law, you know, and all of us being subject to the Constitution, you know, irrespective of who we are, etc. But, you know, there have been times when people, particularly in the ANC, have spoken about finding political solutions for legal or other problems, you know, that some leaders, particularly he himself, Jacob Zuma, might have found himself in. Do you think he may feel betrayed that nobody stood up for him to be afforded a kind of political solution?
Well, definitely, Bramike, he will feel betrayed, especially given the fact that he has benefited from political solutions before. Remember, as Thabo was saying, that in terms of how he has managed to play the law all these years, for instance, you'll remember in his ongoing corruption trial, of which in the next week or so he's appearing in court, those charges have been dropped before. Just, for instance, the last time being 2008, just before he ascended to the union buildings, which was a political solution because at the time it made no legal sense, none whatsoever, for those charges to be dropped at that particular point in time. But at the time, politically, he was at a strong point. He was completely and firmly in charge of the ANC, NEC that emerged from Polokwane. And therefore, that decision that was taken in that particular regard to drop those charges at the time was completely political. So he has benefited before several times from political solutions to legal problems, and which is why he mounted this political campaign that we saw around Gandla and the building of that narrative of a potential violence. It was to push the powers that be and the authorities towards that corner of a political solution once more. But apparently, unfortunately for him, this time around, it couldn't work, and it was never going to work because he is no longer in charge of, you know, the politics of the day and the state, as it were, as he was during his time in the union buildings and as he was as the president of the ANC. So now he has completely lost all that political influence, and he's a nonentity in the bigger scheme of things politically, even going forward. So there's very few people who would want to be seen to be loyal to him. He has nothing to offer to them. You know, with politics, politicians are only loyal to the one who has patronage to dispense in terms of deploying them into positions of power, be it in government, ambassadors, ministers, members of parliament. And at this point in time, Jacob Zuma doesn't have that power to deploy anyone to such positions. So he was never going to have that much support as the one he used to enjoy post Polokwane up to the point that he resigned as president in 2018.
Mm. Prof, you know, the other aspect, you know, of the way the whole story has unfolded. You know, I was watching the former president Jacob Zuma on speaking on the weekend in one of the several places where he was speaking. One of the things he said was that maybe it's time for him to go back, you know, to the struggle, you know, and restart the struggle, you know, because he feels that this is not the democracy that everyone fought for, etc. But at the heart of that seems to be a desire to delegitimize our entire constitutional dispensation as we understand. In fact, to delegitimize the government as well and the judiciary, because he said they don't know how to use the power they've been given, etc. You know, that thread that runs through that kind of argument. Do you think that there is a case to say that maybe the democracy we have is not quite what was fought for?
You know, it's almost, you know, a populist approach, and it's almost inevitable that he's going to take that approach because, you know, he's or was in a corner. And in order to, you know, the way he boxed was to try to portray our current democratic system as not working for ordinary citizens, but also to portray the current leadership in the ANC also, you know, of being, of having sold out, whether it is now, you know, to big business or foreign interests and so on, you know, as a key part of his strategy in order to, you know, mobilize support behind him. So now the unfortunate thing about that kind of strategy, it's, you know, it's an attack on our constitution and an attack on our democratic institutions. And as a former president, you know that you can't do that sort of thing because, you know, as a former president, he signed an oath to defend this constitution and democratic institutions. I mean, elsewhere in the world where people did that, former leaders did that, you know, they got really long and tough sentences. I'm just thinking about South Korea, who had the same type of strategy as Jacob Zuma, you know, when she was investigated for corruption. She then started attacking the constitution, the judiciary, and so on. And that actually, at the end, when they gave her a judgment, they gave her much, much longer judgment. But maybe the important thing here is that, you know, there are some people, unfortunately, in the country who are not totally convinced about our constitution or about, you know, democratic institutions. In fact, there are some people, and particularly in the ANC, who most probably don't believe in democracy. So essentially what we have in South Africa so far, what we had the last couple of years, almost parallel governance systems competing with the constitution. And, you know, the ANC's, under Jacob Zuma, for example, the ANC's own governance system competed with a constitutional democracy system. And if you think about traditional leadership, and that's a competition because, you know, many of the tenets go against democracy. And even like, you know, the smaller scale of kind of gangs that you see in townships and so on, I mean, you know, they've got their own governance system, their own set of rules, which of course also go against the constitution and the democratic system. Now, it was important in this judgment that the ANC actually now, for once and for all, decide which is the premier or the apex governance system. Is it our constitution and the democratic institutions, or is it the ANC's own constitution and way of behaving? Could it be traditional leadership? Would that be a governance system, or gangsterism is all potentially also a governance system? And I think the ANC clearly with this case is almost, you know, South Africa needed a Zuma to take on the constitutional system so that we can define for ourselves, and also the ANC could define for itself, what does it want? Does it want to continue being ambivalent about the constitution or the democratic institutions, or should it embrace it fully, finally? And if it embraced it fully, finally, which I think it has done by agreeing that Jacob Zuma should go to jail and agreeing with the judgment, it would mean that all sorts of other people still in the ANC who oppose or have a different view of what the governance system should be is going to be in a life and death battle with the ANC now going forward.
Hey, Mawande, you were on the ground in Gandla. What is your sense of the people who were there? Would you say this was a spontaneous outpouring of anger, or did it look like something that was organized and stage managed?
Bramak, it was very much organized. It was very far from being spontaneous. I mean, especially if you know, the nice thing about being on the ground, you also manage to observe other things that are happening away from the ground, such as the behavior of people on social media these days of the digital age. And then when you juxtapose the two, the ground and social media, you get a sense to see that things are coordinated or they are happening spontaneously. In this regard, when I did that analysis, I got to a point that it was highly, highly organized. The way things were happening, they were just not spontaneous. The whole issue of firing of guns. For me, the central point was the building of the narrative that should the state or the law move its, you know, long arm to reach finally for former President Zuma, there will be a bloodshed. There was a whole word that was thrown around all over, even in mainstream media, of another Marikana. All those things, if you check that, they were not happening haphazardly. It was things that were planned. You check the centrality of the son of former President Zuma, Edward Zuma, who was constantly, you know, throughout the time where supporters were gathered outside the home of former President Zuma, was there and right at the gate. He was always available for interviews. He was on a war talk consistently. He was actually saying he is willing to lay down his life for his father, which was an inspiration to the rest of the supporters. You know, you check the daughter Dudu Zuma, who's very popular on social media, and what she was doing in that particular platform as well. So it was highly, highly organized, Pramak, and it was highly sponsored, if I may add as well. If you now go to the ground and get to check the kind of, you know, private vehicles that were there, you know, luxury cars, double cabs, Ford, Toyota, you know, Mercedes vans, Mercedes C-classes, all kinds of Jeeps, German and American, the beast, as it were, of the cars. So it had money behind it. It had a lot of thinking behind it. It had a lot of propaganda behind it. It had some element of intelligence operation in it. So in a nutshell, it was highly, highly organized. And it was organized, in, as I said before, to drive, you know, the judiciary and the political authorities of the country to a corner of a political negotiation. Unfortunately, as we now know, it flopped spectacularly.
Okay, Thabo, just looking at the conduct of the police, they seemed to be ambivalent as to what they wanted to do, particularly as the hour approached for Jacob Zuma to be arrested. Did you see the same thing, that they seemed to be unsure or doubtful as to whether to implement the directive of the Constitutional Court or not?
Yeah, but at some point, it seemed the police did not know what to do. I mean, you'll recall on Monday, there was a letter written by the office of the chief state law advisor on behalf of the Minister of Police, asking the acting chief justice, Raymond Zonda. In fact, they were not asking him. They were saying to him that they might not be in a position to execute the arrest because the matter was being argued in the Pietermaritzburg High Court. Whereas the Concord had been clear that come Wednesday and Jacob Zuma had not handed himself over, you go to Nkandla and move in and execute the arrest. So it was quite surprising to see that letter from the Minister of Police asking the Chief Justice to clarify when the Concord order was quite unequivocal on this matter. But I mean, come the last minute yesterday, we saw the police moving in and executing the arrest. Although they do it in such a way that you know, they had to make sure that they avoid any confrontation with the supporters of Jacob Zuma, which is why we understand that this is the reason why they had to persuade SAPS members who form part of the security detail of Jacob Zuma or the VIP protection of Jacob Zuma, because after all, these are employees of the SA Police Service. So this is how it was done. But I think there was also a force on standby somewhere around Nkandla that was ready to move in and reinforce the VIP protection of Jacob Zuma had there been a struggle there. Earlier in the week, it looked like the SAPS was dithering on this matter. But at least at the 11th hour, they did what needed to be done.
The other player in the whole saga, but who was not there physically, is of course the president. He seemed to have chosen to studiously stay out of the fray and say nothing.
You know, I didn't think it was the right approach for the president to go to ground, because clearly, I mean, he was spectacularly absent. Because of his absence, we saw leaders of vacuum in the country for the moment. I mean, the only thing that held us together was the Constitutional Court staying firm. But we had a vacuum. And I mean, I can imagine why he went to ground, is that he didn't want it to be the face of the Zuma attacks or the supporters attacks. And indeed, he almost wanted to have a physical barrier between him and the Constitutional Court judgment executors, the police, and so on. I can see that as a political strategy. But still, I mean, it, would have been important for him, you know, to be right at the center and to reassure South Africans that, you know, the constitution is supreme, the judiciary is independent, and he distanced himself as a president, and but also the ANC, from Jacob Zuma and Jacob Zuma supporters, because Jacob Zuma supporters, they also attacked the constitution, attacked the judiciary, and so on. But I mean, it really is almost symbolic of his presidency the last couple of years. Whenever there's a crisis, he goes to the ground and then he reappears once the crisis is over. I don't think there is good leadership in a crisis. You know, the leader has to stay in front, has to be visible, has to give leadership, you know, has to personify calm, personify the democracy, you know, and personify direction. But again, like in the past, he went to ground.
Let's go to the to the other aspect of our conversation today. Just looking at the state of the ANC in the aftermath of all of this, or while all of this is unfolding. Here one thinks about the suspension, temporary suspension of someone like Karl Niehaus, and of course the problems that are still coming for Ace Magashule, who's also suspended. Have we reached a point of no return in Cyril Ramaphosa's crusade, if you like, to restore ethical leadership in the ANC, Mawande?
Oh yes, Pramak. It does look that way. In fact, I dare even take it further that what we are likely to see in the coming weeks or months or so is President Cyril Ramaphosa even tightening the screws even much further with the likes of the two that you've mentioned, for instance, the likes of Tony Engen and all those, for instance, that have been behind former President Zuma. Because the reality of the situation is that in the ANC, the so-called RET faction was really, gaining, was its strength was really based on former President Zuma. With him now out of the way, with Ace Magashule isolated, as it were, we are awaiting the judgment to the case that he brought against the party to fight his suspension. It is really a one-way traffic for President Cyril Ramaphosa going forward now to affirm his power, to affirm his principles and values to the ANC, as it were, and most likely go on to even win a second term, if I were to be brave, unchallenged, as it were, because it would, with the current events and what we have seen so far, especially this year since he took over the ANC, I think there's a strong message that has been sent that he is, to a certain degree, serious about taking charge of the ANC. As to what ends, it remains to be seen as time goes on, but I doubt that going forward, any rogue elements within the ANC who may have fancied their chances of challenging him may have the guts to do so, Pramay.
Thabo, can Cyril Ramaphosa impose his will or strengthen his grip on the party without splitting it?
I think he can. He can, Pramay. I mean, it's a moment for him to lose. I think it's a moment for him to shine. It's a moment for him to regroup. With Jacob Zuma now out of the way, in jail, Ace Magashule in suspension, I mean, on suspension, Karl Niehaus also out. He's managed to send a message, to everybody who's been trying to frustrate his leadership. He sent out the message to say, hey, guys, I'm in charge. Allow me to, lead the ANC. I've undertaken to lead a renewal of the ANC. So if you look at the balance of forces in the National Executive Committee of the ANC, they've tilted towards his favor. In fact, they've always been in his favor since the election in Nasrec in 2017. But they have not been bold enough because the RET forces have been trying to frustrate them. But with Ace Magashule out of the way, Jacob Zuma out of the way, I don't see how the RET forces will continue to frustrate Cyril Ramaphosa and his reform agenda. If you look at what happened at the special NEC this past week on Monday, where there was an attempt by the RET forces for a task team to be instituted to look after the interest of Jacob Zuma. That was roundly rejected. I understand even the people who usually speak in favor of Jacob Zuma or the RET forces simply kept quiet when Ramaphosa's supporters in the NEC shot down this proposal. So it's really a moment for Cyril to rise to the occasion and reboot his reform agenda. Otherwise, it's a moment for him to lose.
Hey, Prof, the last word goes to you very quickly before we wrap up. Do you think that the cleanup has finally started? I mean, you're critical of Cyril, you know, as a leader who goes to ground when there's crisis. Do you think that he's got the stomach to take the fight through?
Well, I think the opportunity is there now for him. I mean, he's in the driving seat. There's a really great space and opportunity for him to do that. The second thing now for him most probably would be to try to get the economy going. And when you get the economy going, he has to make some very tough decisions. You know, the unions have their objections on the public sector wage bill. We may need to restructure the state-owned companies. You know, again, the unions and the Communist Party are going to oppose that. I think now the big challenge is, can he, on the economy, can he face down, you know, his other group, other critics, or opponents, on the left, sort of on the hard left. And then for me, the last one is, can he now build, you know, a social pact also with the private sector and with civil society, because the state alone doesn't have the capacity to co-govern, to deliver public services, and also to recover the economy. And, you know, there's a whole lot of people in the ANC who opposes that. So it'd be really interesting, but he's got a space to do it.
Okay. Unfortunately, we've just about run out of time, and that's all we'll have time for this week on the Sunday Times Politics Weekly. And I'd like to thank my guests for the conversation: William Kumete, Associate Professor in the School of Governance at WITS, Thabo Mokoni, our parliamentary correspondent, and of course, Mawanda Mashabalala, who's our political correspondent. And by the way, if you'd like to get our podcast, you can find these on iono.fm, Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, or wherever you prefer to get your podcasts. Until next time, stay safe, sanitize, wear the mask, and avoid crowded places. I'm Mike Siluma, signing off.